Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to welcome to the Salieri Report Helen Chapman, who is the has a very distinguished career as an attorney in New York and is currently the chairman of Chapman LLP, and is the co-author of J.P. Madoff, The Unholy Alliance Between America's Biggest Bank and America's Biggest Crook. If you haven't read it, it's a doozy. If you want to understand what's really going on at J.P. Morgan, this is a book you want to read. So, Helen, thank you so much for joining us this morning on the Salieri Report.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I came to know about you and your work from an associate of mine who lost money in Madoff, and I've been able to follow it for many years because sort of the financial frauds in and around J.P. Morgan were of interest to me, including because of the housing bubble. And so I've watched you from afar, and then when you posted your website for J.P. Madoff, I was very impressed. Couldn't wait to get the book, so I got the book immediately. And so I just have to get you to tell the story of why you wrote J.P. Madoff.
I became involved in helping Madoff victims because I myself was a victim. And this happened in December of 2008. My area of specialty as a lawyer was litigation involving financial institutions. I've termed the phrase lender liability in the early 1980s and wrote a treatise called The Law of Lender Liability, which was published in 1990. And so it was always my area of specialty, and my law practice was always litigation involving financial institutions. And in 2008, when the economy collapsed, all of the banks stopped litigating. It didn't matter what the case was or what stage the proceeding was in. No bank was willing to pay 3 cents to litigate. So my law practice came to a complete stop. And then on December 11th, I learned that I had lost all my investment assets. So I was a little depressed, as one could imagine, but I also had nothing, I had no income coming in because I only earn income based on what I do, and my practice had come to a halt. So I figured, well, I might as well do something to help people since I can't do anything else, and I let it be known that I would help people on a pro bono basis with life issues. People had 99-year-old mothers in nursing homes and couldn't afford to pay the nursing home. What could they do? Some of them didn't even have money to buy food because everything they had been invested in Madoff. So that's how it all started, and I operated a 24-hour hotline for people around the country. And then gradually I thought, well, how can I help these people? And I realized that the Internal Revenue Procedures allowing a theft loss, which would give someone a tax refund for the last 5 years that they paid taxes on fictitious income, that was not clear. And I and a number of other people went to Congress and started lobbying for clarification of this provision. And in fact, by March of 2009, Revenue Procedure 2009-20 was promulgated by the Internal Revenue Service, and that allowed people to apply for tax refunds, and the IRS agreed to give them within 45 days. So that was wonderful. And that was the beginning, and then I gradually began representing claimants and then representing defendants in the notorious clawback actions that Irving Picard, the trustee, has filed. I became involved.
It's a marvelous story, and you're still, of course, involved today, correct?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
And if I can just pick up on that, so it became known that I was a spokesperson for the victims, and sometime in late 2009, after Madoff had been imprisoned, I had never met him or spoken with him, but I was walking down Lexington Avenue and my cell phone rang and the voice said, "Hello, Helen, this is Ruth Madoff." And of course I had never met Ruth, and I said, "Hello, Ruth, how are you?" And she said, "I'm fine. Bernie wants to talk to you." And I said, "Well, how do we arrange that?" And she said, "Well, if you give me a landline number, he'll call you collect tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. So that's how it started. And then Bernie wanted me to come to the prison to visit him, and I applied. And the prison warden, in her infinite wisdom, decided that I would be a threat to the security of the prison. So I didn't know if that was because I'm so gorgeous that I would start a prison riot or because I always carry a gun. But in any event, I never was able to visit Bernie in prison, but I've spoken to him many, many times on the phone. And he, in one of my first conversations, said, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase knew from day one what I was doing. And when he first said that to me, I thought it couldn't have been true. But he was telling me the truth.
Right. One of my questions, which we'll get to, is was J.P. Morgan the senior partner? It's just, which is how it looks to me. But let me not jump ahead. Why don't you, for the people who are listening who are not familiar with Madoff and the Madoff fraud, could you just give us an overview of what the fraud was, how it happened? I know it's a very complex situation, and your book does a marvelous job of sort of unpacking it and making it clear. But if you could just give us the 411 on Madoff as a fraud.
Sure. Bernie Madoff started an investment advisory business. He was a broker-dealer on Wall Street, and he started a business in 1960. And he operated from 1960 to 2008. And he never went under until Bear Stearns went under and Lehman Brothers went under. Madoff employed approximately 200 people, of which about 190 were engaged in a legitimate trading operation. Madoff did what's called market making for the major investment houses, Bear Stearns, Schwab, Merrill Lynch. He had people, companies like that as his customers. And he did trades at certain periods equal to 10% of the daily volume on the New York Stock Exchange. This is huge. This is more than Goldman Sachs does or Merrill Lynch does. He was a huge player on Wall Street. And then he was elected to he became president of the NASDAQ. And he was revered by everybody. There were people who, beginning in the late 1990s, reported to the SEC that they felt he was operating a Ponzi scheme, not with respect to the market-making business, but with respect to the investment advisory business, that he had five or six people running of the 200 people he employed. And as to this investment advisory business, the SEC investigated it six times over 16 years, involving 122 separate individuals who worked for the SEC. And there were times when someone young would report to a senior person, I think Mr. Madoff is lying to us, he's done something dishonest, he's done something illegal. And time and time again, that person would be taken off the team and assigned to a different project. So Madoff was a protected individual on Wall Street, and the SEC protected him just as much as a number of other people that should have uncovered what happened. But he became a household word for a lot of people. I have a number of clients who are third-generation Madoff investors.
Right. Right. I've seen that pattern several times now. It was inconceivable for people that it wasn't a reliable investment, because they or their family had had such a long experience with it that it was inconceivable. It definitely, you know, always appeared to them to be a rock solid part of the system. In other words, Madoff was an insider.
Right, and a respected insider. And I don't think that anyone had reason to believe that he was doing something dishonest. You know, there were some hedge funds that, starting in, you know, around 2005, when the hedge fund investments increased so radically, the hedge funds were inducing a lot of people to invest who didn't know where their money was being invested. But the people who had been third-generation Madoff investors considered that it was like U.S. Treasury notes. They had absolutely no reason to believe that there was anything wrong.
Now, is it fair to say that all the statements that went out to the investment advisory clients were, in essence, fabrications? that the securities and were really never there?
When Madoff pled guilty, he said that he started falsifying the statements in the early 1990s, and that before that, everything was completely legitimate. And even though Irving Picard, the Madoff trustee, claims that that's not true, Picard has no evidence that that's not true. So I don't know what the answer is on that. I think that Madoff he's not an honest person, and he probably never was an honest person. But mm-hmm. I don't know whether or not he purchased securities for his investment advisory customers from 1960 to 1992. I just don't know the answer to that. Certainly, I've never heard an allegation that with respect to his market-making business, which again was 90% of his business, I've never heard an allegation that he was dishonest with respect to that business.
Right. Right. So, so one of the things that comes out when you read the book is that clear, you know, it looks to me like Morgan, J.P. Morgan, which was Madoff's lead bank. Is it fair to describe them as Madoff's lead bank?
With respect to the investment advisory business, it was the only bank.
Okay.
The market-making business banked with other banks. So the only
right.
part of Madoff's business that J.P. Morgan Chase had any connection to was the investment advisory business.
So from reading the logistics of how the business worked and how it was managed over, particularly from the 1990s on, it sounded to me like J.P. Morgan Chase was the senior partner, not the junior partner. And in other words, Madoff worked for them, not vice versa.
Well, you know, that's intriguing because in a sense, you're right. It's not that J.P. Morgan Chase made the decisions as to who would deposit money, obviously. But J.P.
Right.
Morgan Chase sat there and saw every check that was deposited into what was called the 703 account. That was the number of the account. So they knew that the upstate New York plumbers' pension fund was invested in Madoff. They knew that universities had invested in Madoff. They knew that charities had invested in Madoff. And they had a glass-bottom boat view of the activity in the account. They knew that, as they were required to know by federal law, they knew that Madoff was using this account solely for his investment advisory business. And they knew that he never purchased securities with any of the money.
Who was supposedly doing the custodian and clearance work for the investment advisory accounts?
There was a man named William Cassa who was the account officer and the relationship manager. And it was his job under written policies that J.P. Morgan Chase had to comply with the Bank Secrecy Act, which was a statute enacted by Congress in 1970 in recognition of the fact that if you wanted to prevent financial crimes, you had to have the cooperation of the banks. And so the Bank Secrecy Act imposed upon banks the obligation to know their customers, to understand
right.
the cash flow in a business, and to monitor the customers' accounts and inform the federal government if there was any suspicious activity, and of course, if you felt there was suspicious activity, to close the account.
Right.
Cassa was the man who had the obligation at J.P. Morgan Chase throughout a 20-year period to monitor that account and report suspicious activity. Now, the biggest check-hiding scheme in the history of the world involving $106 billion, with a B, dollars, was carried out between Madoff and one of his crooked cronies, Norman Levy. And J.P. Morgan Chase, in 1994, wrote an internal memo saying, it looks like Levy and Madoff are kiting checks, and we want to make sure that we don't pay interest on the kited funds. They weren't concerned that they were doing something illegal. They just wanted to make sure that they were not losing money on it.
Right, right. But the money came into the account, so I still don't understand. The money came into the account, and supposedly it's got to go someplace. And in theory, if he's buying securities, it's got to go to an account that is part of the clearance process. So was I'm assuming Madoff was operating as its own custodian. So Morgan wasn't the securities custodian for the investment advisory business.
Right. There was no securities custodian. There were no securities purchased.
Right, but in theory... So in theory, what I'm assuming Madoff was telling the people doing due diligence for the various institutions that looked at him, you know, that he was the custodian.
Yes.
Okay, so, but Morgan, the money comes in, Morgan has to see it go out. It went out someplace.
It went out to Norman Levy, one of Madoff's big conspirators. It went out to Jeffrey Pickhower, who was, according to Madoff, the mastermind of the fraud, and certainly the largest beneficiary of it, just on that particular issue. A lot of people don't realize that when Madoff's total net worth was liquidated, the Madoff trustee realized $125 million. Jeffrey Pickhower put in $650 million into Madoff and took out $7.8 billion. And that was over a 25-year period. So if you simply invested that net amount, which was $7.2 billion, if you invested that in Treasury notes over that 25-year period, it would have tripled in value. So there's good reason to believe that Pickhower, assuming he had no other source of income, and which is not true because he had a number of different businesses that were very successful, but even just from the Madoff theft, he would have had a net worth of $30 billion.
Right. So so I'll get to conjecture later about where the money might have gone. But needless to say, it is impossible that J.P. Morgan did not know that this was not a real investment advisory business. Whatever it was a front for something else. And it's impossible that they didn't know.
I mean, I agree.
It was in their face every day almost two decades. Okay. And that's why I say, were they the junior partner or the senior partner? Okay. One of the things you do in the book is you then transition from the Madoff fraud and describe a series of different systemic frauds or a pattern of systemic fraud at J.P. Morgan. So maybe if you could just go through some of the other situations you describe in the book.
Sure. I just want to step back because, I feel that President Obama has done a tremendous disservice to the people of this country by allowing Eric Holder to espouse this farce that we can't afford to prosecute a criminal who works at a large financial institution because the economy will collapse. And when you think about it, if the viability and sustainability of J.P. Morgan Chase depends upon the continued employment of someone who has committed felonies, then the institution should be closed. And what I've done is I've started, as you say, with the Madoff fraud and the fact that I know who at J.P. Morgan Chase was monitoring that account and who knew exactly what was going on. And then you go and you analyze other activities of J.P. Morgan Chase, and you inevitably come to the conclusion that it's actually run like the Gambino crime family. The bank figures out, in no matter what area of their business, they figure out how to violate the law because that's where the real profits are. And when they get caught, thanks to Obama and Eric Holder, all they do is cough up as a penalty a small percentage of the profits they realize from their criminal conduct, and then they move on to the next crime.
See, I would describe that not as an enforcement fee. I would describe that as a kickback. Because what you're go ahead.
I love that. You're absolutely right. It is like a kickback because, of course, why would Obama allow Eric Holder, his attorney general, to espouse such a facially absurd policy as to allow Wall Street to be peopled with people who are no better than mobsters? And the answer is that these are the people who are supporting the political campaigns. Obama got millions of dollars from Wall Street, and in particular from J.P. Morgan Chase. And unfortunately, Hillary Clinton, I mean, how can she accept $675,000 for doing three speeches for Goldman Sachs? What does that really mean?
Right.
You know, her answer is that that's what they were willing to pay her. Well, why would they be paying that money? They're not. They're
right,
not
it's
a
legal kickback scheme, right?
Yes, it is. It is.
Right.
So basically, we know that they pled guilty to two felonies with respect to the Madoff relationship, two felony violations of the Bank Secrecy Act, and then that cost them $1.7 billion. But during, I don't have all of the information, I just know what the government has released in its stipulation with J.P. Morgan Chase. From 2003 to 2007, Bernie Madoff kept on deposit at J.P. Morgan Chase in the 703 account $3 to $7 billion. Now, this is before the Fed started throwing money out the window to the banks. So how much is it worth? Remember the days when you would get a toaster if you opened up a bank account with $5,000? So
right.
What do you get if you leave $3 to $5 billion? In the bank.
A great deal of, right, a great deal of, I mean, the float on that account was astonishing.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't realize that the banks have the right to invest that money. And in fact, when Jamie Dimon in 2004 came to J.P. Morgan Chase, he had this idea of setting up the chief investment office in London, which became the scene for the London Whale fiasco. Well,
right.
What was he doing? He was taking depositors' money and speculating with it and making a fortune for the bank until it all collapsed.
Right, doing proprietary trading with it, right.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, you have to assume that Madoff's $3 to $5 billion was what started that office, because it's inconceivable that any other customer would have had funds like that on deposit.
Well, actually, there was another customer that could have done it. But let me step back and let's dive into the government side of this and then come back to the other frauds. My background in this is I served as Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration, and then ended up as the lead financial, or my company ended up as the lead financial advisor for FHA for years. And I ended up in very ugly litigation with the federal government starting in 1996, 1997. And I just decided in the middle of it to get to the bottom of the housing fraud. It was really, at the root of the problem was the discrepancy between what the law said the government was supposed to be doing in the housing area and what was really going on. And if you looked at both my experience as Assistant Secretary of Housing or lead financial advisor, any time over the last 20 years somebody came into the government housing operations, saw that it wasn't running as it was supposed to according to law, started to fix it, bam, they got thrown out, they got fired, they got, you know, some of them had died under suspicious circumstances. And the immunity of the institution to being run, you know, according to the law was extraordinary. And I finally decided, okay, I'm going to get to the bottom of what's really going on. And I have to tell you, J.P. Morgan Chase was right at the heart of it. And where I came out, let me step back. I was also, I don't know if you remember the first American Bank situation. Clark Clifford was the chairman of the bank
course.
That had
yes,
been...
Oh, of course, yes.
Right, okay. Well, Harry Albright was appointed by Morgenthau. Harry was both a friend and a business associate. Morgenthau appointed him as the trustee, and there was a squabble because the asset forfeiture fund at the Department of Justice was trying to grab all the money, and Morgenthau wanted it to go back to the depositors who'd been harmed. So Harry got put as the trustee, and Harry asked me to come on the board to help sort of govern the situation. And the first thing that happened, Helen, I had a big house with all glass windows overlooking the Potomac, and Harry had the law firm send out a Brinks truck to my house with, I don't know, 2,000 pages plus of legal documents. And I spent 3 days, I'm a speed reader, reading everything. And when I finished, I realized this could only have happened Everything that Clifford and his team were doing could only have happened if the White House, the New York Fed, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, the controller of the currency, the secretary of the, institutionally, everyone had to have gone along with it top down. And what I realized you were looking at was something, it was a creature very different than an individual fraud. It was part of a system. And so when I dove in and started looking at the mortgage, it was the same thing. So I decided I would step back and try and figure out why the federal government and the New York Fed member banks were basically engaging in massive systemic fraud on a huge scale. And so when I look at something like the $1.7 billion payment by J.P. Morgan Chase back to Department of Justice, what I basically see at this point are two partners who are in business together, and this is the process by which they split up the profits. It's a legal mechanism that can look okay in the papers, and they call it a fine, but it's not a fine. It's basically a kickback between two partners. That's how they share the government's portion of the profits. Because if you look at what the government did to engineer and support and facilitate the Madoff scandal, that's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to get the SEC to stand down many, many times for many, many years. So
That's a brilliant way of looking at it. It's fascinating because as you were talking, I was thinking about a couple of years ago, you may remember that HSBC was fined a couple of billion dollars for financing terrorists. And when you think of the cost to this country of fighting terrorists and the fact that HSBC violated the law by financing terrorists, and then nobody goes to jail, they just pay back a fine. It's hard to believe that could happen, but it's the same thing. You're right. It's just a division of the profits.
Well, what happened? I don't know if you're familiar with the Exchange Stabilization Fund. The Exchange Stabilization Fund is a fund run by. It's under the law. It essentially is under the umbrella of the Secretary of the Treasury, but it is managed on behalf of the Secretary of the Treasury by the New York Fed member banks. And if you try and do a FOIA on, to the New York Fed or the Fed, basically what they say is, we don't have that because it's managed by those banks directly for the Secretary of Treasury. It's one of the reasons that appointment, along with White House counsel, is so important. At the end of World War II, the money seized by the United States at the end of the war, both in Asia and the Europe, some of them were moved, my belief is, into a hidden system of finance, and some were moved into the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And those two pots of money became the basis of financing secret projects and highly confidential projects. Literally, the intelligence community was put in charge of the hidden system of finance, the New York Fed member banks running the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And the Exchange Stabilization Fund became, among other things, the mother of all slush funds, not only sort of dribbling out that money, but it has wide powers to engage in all sorts of market interventions on behalf of the government. And anyway, so I won't bore you with the whole story, and I have lots of information on this if you're interested. But
oh my God, not boring. I'm intrigued by this.
What grew out of it, from what I can tell, is basically an enterprise. You have a hidden system of finance. You have the Exchange Stabilization Fund used, among other things, as a slush fund and a market intervener. And then this money gets leveraged with all sorts of activities, which you and I would describe many of them as systemic frauds, levered with things like mortgage fraud and derivatives. And what you've created is part of the federal credit mechanism by which the New York Fed member banks finance the U.S. government. So whether it's the overt financing, so treasuries being issued, or the covert financing, which is secret projects and intervening and managing the markets, you, the president, the Secretary of Treasury, are completely dependent on the New York Fed member banks for both overt financing and covert financing. And so, you know, to the extent that they're financing, and I, because I believe part of where all this money's going is into intelligence agencies and sort of secret operations, you're dependent on these guys to basically implement this. And you've got a construct that says under national security law, this is all legal, or that's how you're going to defend it. And basically what you've built is a machinery that's running around and engaging in massive organized crime. You can't penalize a banker for doing that, because if you penalize one, then everybody will stop doing all the things you need to get the money you need for the budget. So you're in a double bind.
Right. That's really unbelievable.
Well, it would sound completely absurd if... But what is if you look at the fact pattern of the frauds, and the fact that no banker has been held accountable for any of this, and it continues to happen. You know, I would never have believed it if I hadn't gone through basically all the housing frauds year after year after year. You know, the 80s, the 90s, because my job basically in the Bush administration and then the Clinton administration was to clean up and stop the mortgage fraud. And, you know, what I discovered was it was unstoppable, because there was a giant sucking sound coming from way senior to the White House demanding that cash. So I've gone off. But let's go back to the U.S. government. It's clear to say that if you'd been Attorney General, something very different would have happened.
There's no question about it. There's no question about it. And believe me, if Bernie Sanders were elected, I would give anything to be his Attorney General. But the banks would have a real worry at that point. But, you know, if you may have seen Matt Taibbi's article in Rolling Stone about Elaine Fleishman.
No, I didn't. Oh, was that the Federal Reserve whistleblower?
Yes.
Yes,
not the
yes,
Federal Reserve whistleblower. That was with Goldman Sachs. But Elaine Fleishman worked for J.P. Morgan Chase. And in 2005, I believe it was, she's a lawyer, and she was working on the sales of the garbage housing loans. And she said to her superior, "We can't make these representations in the prospectus because they're not true as to the quality of the loans that we're selling." And the guy said, "No." He sent out a memo saying, "Nobody is to send any emails, nobody is to comment upon the quality of the loans, etc." So Elaine then went to this man's superior and said, "Look, you know, we can't describe the loans the way we're describing them in this portfolio because it's not accurate." And that guy decided that Elaine really belonged in a different department of the bank. And then, of course, she was terminated. And she was deposed by the government in connection with its investigation of J.P. Morgan Chase's mortgage fraud. And before the $13 billion settlement was announced, where that was the settlement between the federal government and J.P. Morgan Chase with respect to its fraudulent mortgage practices,
right,
she was led to believe that they were going to prosecute J.P. Morgan Chase. And, of course, I'm sure there was never an intention on the part of Eric Holder to prosecute J.P. Morgan Chase. It was just, a decision to try to get money out of it and to make... There was so much public pressure that they had to do something that would create a big headline. And so the headline was that it was a $13 billion settlement. But in fact, $4 billion of the $13 was so-called consumer relief, where the government was going to trust J.P. Morgan Chase to provide consumer relief.
Right.
And, of course, some of that consumer relief consisted of J.P. Morgan Chase releasing liens on loans that it had previously sold to third parties.
Right. So one of the things I would find is a lot of times when the government would intervene, it was not so much to penalize the perpetrator who really was a partner in the perpetration, but to assert control over the situation. So
right, exactly.
By
yes.
asserting control, they would stop the civil and private litigants from making any headway, not just respect to holding people accountable, but to bringing real transparency to what had happened.
Well, you know, that's the structure of the False Claims Act, which is the statute that allows whistleblowers to report situations where the government is being cheated. And very often the government takes over the case, not in order to assure that the government isn't cheated, but rather to assure that the cheating that's been established with the government's complicity can continue.
Right, exactly. Believe it or not, I was the target of a QTAM, so I'm very familiar.
Oh, really?
With the false claim. Yeah, yeah. A lot of times what they'll do is they, if they want to get somebody honest out, they'll target them under the whistleblower statute. And it's quite interesting. In fact, I'll send you, we ended up writing up a lot about the case and putting a lot of the legal documents online. And one of the ways we were able to finally deal effectively with the situation was just making so much of the legal documentation available that that it sort of shifted things. And so Department of Justice, we talked about SEC, Department of Justice. One of the most intriguing parts of your involvement and the Madoff case is the SIPC situation. And I think that's very important for investors to know about. So maybe if you could describe what happened on Madoff with SIPC.
Oh, this is one of the most discouraging parts of the whole story, because the Securities Investor Protection Act was enacted in 1970, which was really a banner year. That was the year that Congress enacted the Bank Secrecy Act and, of course, the Securities Investor Protection Act. And both statutes have been nullified in the last decade. And the Securities Investor Protection Act set up the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. It was enacted during the administration of Nixon, and he said when he signed the bill that this was going to provide SIPC insurance to people who invested in the stock market, comparable to FDIC insurance for people who put money in a bank. And the stated purpose of Securities Investor Protection Act was to encourage average, honest, hardworking Americans to put their money in the stock market, because it insured each account up to $500,000 if the broker was dishonest and stole the money and didn't buy the securities, or the broker bought the securities and then stole the securities.
So let me step back. So if you had your money in Madoff, let's say you're a teacher and you had saved $450,000 in your whole life, you had it all in Madoff, and you felt secure having it all in Madoff because you knew under $500,000, you knew 100% of your account was SIPC insured, right?
That's right, exactly.
Right. So what happened?
Okay, so, and in the early stages, that is in December of 2008, when I was talking to Madoff victims, they all said, well, I know I'm going to get my $500,000, because, of course, on every statement it says SIPC insured. And if you
right.
go to see your Merrill Lynch broker, there's going to be a bronze plaque on his desk which says SIPC insured, and everybody thinks, oh, this is like FDIC insurance. Well, forget about it, because the mistake that Congress made was it allowed the Wall Street firms to run SIPC and to decide how much money should be put into the insurance fund. So the Wall Street firms, typically, in the period from 1996 through 2008, set the fee for SIPC insurance at $150 a year per firm. So Goldman Sachs, let's say they have a million customer accounts. They assured each customer that the account was insured up to $500,000. And for the ability to do that, They paid one check of $150 to SIPC each year. Merrill Lynch probably had 30 million customer accounts. They paid one check of $150 to SIPC. So over the years, the Subcommittee on Capital Markets in the House had on a number of occasions written to SIPC and said, hey guys, you know, maybe $150 isn't enough. Maybe you're not going to have enough to cover a major liquidation. Well, the Wall Street firms loved it because they were getting the benefit of assuring the public that their money was safe up to $500,000, and they didn't have to pay for it. What could be better? And then 2008 happens. Lehman files, Madoff files, and SIPC says, well, we don't have enough money to cover this. Well, what there were two choices. One was to assess the SIPC members as they should have been assessed from 1996 to 2008, or the alternative was to screw the investors. And obviously, that was an irresistible alternative. So all of a sudden, the president of SIPC, Steve Harbeck, started telling the press, you know, the statute doesn't mean what it says. And even though as recently as a week ago, the general counsel of SIPC said every Madoff customer is insured up to $500,000, she misspoke. She didn't really understand the statute. She's only been working for us for 30 years, and she got it wrong. What the statute means is that if your broker was dishonest and didn't buy the securities, then you only get your net investment. So of the $64.8 billion in outstanding claims among approximately 5,200 Madoff accounts, SIPC insured only about $16 billion of that amount. They only insured about 2,200 accounts. And the $16 billion was the full account value. They only insured up to $500,000 per 2,200 accounts. So they reduced their liability for SIPC insurance by about $1.5 billion. And then they spent more than $1.5 billion.
Helen, they did that by saying that all the dividends you've gotten since the beginning were netted?
You don't count. Because Madoff was a crook, and they decided that he was a crook since 1960. If someone put money in 1960 and never, let's say my grandfather put $100,000 into Madoff in 1960, and that appreciated, you know, over the years, and I mean, if you'd bought IBM in 1960, $100,000, it would be worth $10 million today. So
right.
Let's say that my grandfather died in 2006, and left me a Madoff account of $10 million, and he had never taken any money out. I would have paid $5 million to the federal government in estate taxes, and Irving Picard, the Madoff trustee, would be suing me for $4,900,000 because my grandfather put in $100,000 and I took out $5
million. Right.
And
right.
I'm now representing approximately 100 people who've been sued on that basis.
Right.
So they didn't get SIPC insurance, and now whatever little meager assets they have left, they're being sued to recover.
Right. So basically SIPC took most of a pass, and now the trustee is coming back for essentially value gained. Now, is it all gains over your principal? Does it include dividends, or it's just the capital gains?
It's anything you took out. It's a cash in, cash out calculation.
Okay. So any cash you took out, and that goes all the way back to 1960.
Yes, and let's take, you know, a physician. I represent a 98-year-old physician who had an IRA account. And from the time he was 70 and a half, he took out mandatory IRA withdrawals. He paid half of it to the federal government. he can't get that back from the federal government, but Picard is suing him for the money
for
he paid
total?
The federal government.
You're kidding.
No. And then we were successful in thank God we got the Second Circuit to do the right thing on this. The bankruptcy code does not permit fraudulent transfer actions against customers of a stockbroker unless you can show actual fraud and the transfer can only have occurred within the last 2 years of the broker's existence. Picard had used the state fraudulent transfer law and we had sued for 6 years of clawbacks, and we ended up succeeding on that issue, and I was thrilled about that. Picard sought cert, and the Supreme Court and I opposed it, and the Supreme Court denied cert. So Picard was unable to recover against a lot of my clients who hadn't taken money out in the last 2 years but had taken out money before that. I believe that ultimately the Second Circuit will hold that Picard does not have the right to claw back from anyone because it's a distortion of the law. The law since Elizabeth I in 1645, I think, enacted the first fraudulent transfer statute, and every single fraudulent transfer statute since Elizabeth I has had an exception. The statutes have all said that if a payment is made to a creditor in good faith in satisfaction of an antecedent debt, it, no matter what the intent of the transferor was, the transferee is entitled to keep the money. Now, Madoff customers have had a debtor-creditor relationship with Madoff. When they took out money, it reduced the amount that Madoff owed them. And if in 2007 I had wanted to take money out of my Madoff account and Madoff said, I'm not giving it to you, I would have marched right into New York Supreme Court and I would have gotten a court judgment or order compelling Madoff to turn over the money to me because it was he owed me that money. So, and Picard doesn't allege that any of the customers knew that Madoff was a criminal. Of course they didn't. So these are all good faith customers, and the concept that you can sue a creditor is inconsistent with 400 years of law.
Right, but here's the problem, and I'm just going to talk politics now. If you're the New York Fed member banks and the government and SIPC, you're all these different organizations together because they're running a day-to-day business that is raising and financing both the government overt and covert. What you need is what's the total number of Madoff victims?
The total number is 35,000. The account holders is 5,240.
5,240.
Okay. 5,240 account holders.
So let's talk about those 5,000 people. In my experience, just from the Madoff victims I've known, you've got a lot of really smart, successful people. These are people who have a lot of intelligence, a lot of education, a lot of power in formal and informal ways. What you need is for them not to understand what was going on, because if they really understood what was going on, then the reality is the U.S. government and the New York Fed member banks owe them back every penny, plus interest, plus, you know, money for the harm that's, you know, the time that's been done, the stress that's been hit. I mean, because a fraud was perpetrated on them. And traditionally in these kinds of situations, the best defense is a good offense. So projective identification, you accuse them of what you were doing. So, you know, they were doing business with a fraudster. They should have known better. You know, part of this is just pure politics, but it looks to me, if you look at what Picard has done, if you look at what SIPC has done, the people who perpetrated this fraud, and remember, they're not just worried about this one, they're worried about all the ones they've got going. The people who perpetrated need that 5,000 account holders to not grok what's going on.
You know, I don't represent the 5,000 account holders, but I represent a significant percentage of them. And
right.
I have done everything that I could think of to help them. I sued the SEC under the Federal Tort Claims Act. for negligence, because the Congress has waived sovereign immunity with respect to the negligence of an officer of the federal government. And I allege that it was negligent for the SEC to have failed to uncover Madoff's fraud, and further, that the SEC affirmatively stated in a press release to the Wall Street Journal in 1992, when a feeder fund to Madoff went under and the SEC closed it down, and then it turned out that that feeder fund just fed the money to Madoff, and the issue was, had the SEC investigated Madoff? And the SEC issued a press release, which was published in the Wall Street Journal, saying they had investigated Madoff and Madoff came out completely clean. Now, the truth was they had never investigated Madoff. But even with that undisputed record, my case was dismissed. The court held that there's no standing to sue the federal government on the facts of this. I filed a lawsuit against SIPC. I had a similar result there. So what you have to appreciate is that it's not simply that there's the alliance that you've described between the government, the Department of Justice, and Wall Street. The courts are now peopled with judges who have an overwhelming sympathy for Wall Street and for large corporations.
Right. Right. So it's very, very difficult to achieve relief in the courts.
That's exactly right.
Did Madoff have an E&O insurer provider? I'm assuming not.
I don't know that he did. I don't think he did, and it wouldn't have protected for fraud. There's always an exception in those policies.
Right. Right. So, so you continue to represent against the trustee claims, and where does that stand?
I had been defending about 140 cases, and a number of my clients' cases were dismissed because of that limitation to 2-year withdrawals. I'm now down to about 95 cases, and we've just started discovery. And we have to wait until in any case, whether it's one that I'm defending or someone else is defending, we have to get that to the Second Circuit on the issue that I described earlier about the defendants being innocent creditors, and that there can't be a fraudulent transfer claim against an innocent creditor. We should win on that issue because the law is absolutely clear. I can't guarantee that I'll win on it because the courts don't always follow the law. But if the Second Circuit follows the law, we should win on that, and that would result in the dismissal of all these cases.
There was a great moment in my it was the Keetam case and a related case where the judge, who was the former CIA general counsel, we had a Supreme Court case, a recent Supreme Court case, on point. And my attorney, with his voice cracking, he said, "But Your Honor, you have to do it. It's the law." And the judge says, "Well, Mr. McManus, I disagree with the law. So if you have a problem with that, take it up with Congress." I think you would have laughed if you had been there. Okay, so one of my favorite parts in your book is on page 177 when you say, "It is impossible to explain why the American public, 50% of whose households do business with J.P. Morgan Chase, would accept criminality from a financial institution. I can no more fathom why anyone would bank with J.P. Morgan Chase. I just can't even fathom it. And yet, more and more people seem to be doing it as though it's perfectly safe."
Yeah, it's really horrifying. It's really horrifying because I'm sure you've seen it, this roulette wheel on my website, J.P. Madoff.
Right.
It's in the middle of the homepage. And if you click on the roulette wheel, it revolves, and then it stops wherever. And then it's each slice of the roulette wheel is a different judgment that J.P. Morgan Chase has paid out just in the last 5 years. And the total amount that they have paid out in fines and settlements for violating the law or defrauding people is $36 billion. And it ranges from defrauding veterans to credit card holders to homeowners to improperly managing trusts that they are the trustees of. There's no aspect of their business that isn't permeated by fraud and dishonesty. And it's just remarkable that they get away with it.
So let me ask you something. The website has been up now for a while. What is the response you've gotten from the media and the general public to both the book and the website?
Well, the major media will not acknowledge any of these issues.
Right.
In fact, I had a very interesting experience. I had been asked on the 6th anniversary of Madoff's confession. I'd been invited by Maria Bartiromo to appear on Opening Bell. And I was about to go on a vacation, and I bought all of her books that she'd written, and I dutifully read them on the vacation, assuming that I would have to be able to talk to her about her books and compliment them. And I had emailed the producer who had invited me a couple of times and asked him what it was that that Maria wanted me to talk about, and he wrote back and said, well, whatever you are doing. And I said, well, take a look at jpmadoff.com, and you'll see what I'm working on now. Well, unfortunately, the fellow, I guess, didn't have time to do that. So I show up at Fox Business's offices in New York, and they take 45 minutes to make me up. And this lovely lady did a wonderful job making me up on the understanding that I was going to be on for 7 minutes, which in TV is a lot of time.
Right.
And I didn't meet Maria before I went on camera, so I was brought in, and you know, there's a setup, kind of an L-shaped desk, and she's on one side of the L, and I sit down on the other side of the L. And she says, and now we have with us Helen Davis Chapman, the leading lawyer representing the Madoff victims. Now, Ms. Chapman, tell us what you're working on. I said, well, at the moment, I'm suing J.P. Morgan Chase. And, of course, J.P. Morgan Chase is one of the primary sponsors of Opening Bell. So she says, suing J.P. Morgan Chase? For heaven's sake, what are you suing them for? And I said, well, the evidence shows that they knew for 20 years that Madoff was committing a crime, and they allowed him to continue as a bank customer, and they should have shut him down. Well, why would they have an obligation to shut him down?
Is this live?
It's live. So I thought,
well,
they would have an obligation to shut him down because under the Bank Secrecy Act, which was enacted in 1970, Congress made it a crime for banks not to monitor their customers' accounts and not to shut down criminal activity and report it to the federal government. So at that, I could hear a lot of static in her earpiece, and at that moment, she announced an emergency commercial. So we go off camera, and I'm a little bit shocked because I knew I had 7 minutes. And she said, I'm really sorry, but we had an emergency. So I said, well, it happened so quickly, I couldn't figure out what was going on. I said, are we going to continue? And she said, no, this is it. Thank you very much. Goodbye. And two men came and escorted me out. And then I went to pick up my coat, and this poor lady who had spent 45 minutes making me up because she figured I'd be on for 7 minutes, she said, what happened? And I said, I don't know.
So this has happened to me. I have a standing instructions to my staff because someone will call and say they want me on such and such a show, and they'll get all excited because it's a show with major market share, and I tell them, look, it's going to be canceled. We'll prepare and we'll say yes, but it's going to be canceled, and they're always canceled. It's usually the morning of. So somebody higher up figures out what? Boom! It's canceled. Yeah. Well, right. Tell us, what can we do? Because I'm a great believer in you work with what you've got. What could the people listening to this do to help you and the Madoff victims and to help your efforts?
I just want them to help themselves. The book that I wrote doesn't help the Madoff victims. They learned the lesson the hard way. But I just want to, I feel, you know, this whole change in the pattern of and focus of my legal career was, the word fortuitous came to mind. I can't really say it was fortuitous, but it gave me an opportunity to try to help people. And I want so desperately to educate the public so that they can protect themselves.
Right. It really matters. One of the things I constantly say to people is you want to limit who you do business with to parties that have both excellence in the competency of what they do, but also have integrity. And it's pretty clear. You know, I always say to people who love money in MF Global, why, you know, if John Corzine came to run that institution, why did you stay? What were you thinking? So I think we grew up in a world where the government was going to fix everything and we didn't have to worry about doing old-timey due diligence, but now we do. And it really matters that you're banking with an institution whose primary business is serving individual customers, and they have to have integrity to do it or they go out of business. And that doesn't include everybody. It's a portion of the banking system. It's not everybody. So we have to be able to differentiate, and it's extremely important. You know, if everybody in the country just said, you know, we're not going to talk to, associate with, we're not going to date, we're not going to marry, we're not going to do business with, you know, anybody who is part of these kinds of activities, a lot of it would stop. It couldn't go on.
I agree with you, but it's, and you know, I actually feel that the movement of the economy and the political system in the last 30 years is untenable for a long-term basis. I mean, it's like we've become a feudal society, and my own view was that it was going to end up in violence, because at some point the public was going to stand up and rebel. And I thought it was going to end up in a civil war. But I was so encouraged by the fact that Bernie Sanders has such widespread support among young people. And it really gives me hope that Bernie Sanders has been the strongest voice expressing some of what we've talked about. And it really gives me hope. And I hope that people will read my book, because it will give them the hardcore facts which Bernie Sanders rests his views on. And there are voices like yours and like mine and like Bernie Sanders, and we just have to continue speaking, because, you know, we are a democracy, and if people stand up and vote, the majority of people is being victimized. And if they stand up and vote, they can change this, but it means changing Congress completely, because there are very few people in Congress who are not corrupted by the process. I tend to think that, you know, it's actually become very easy for people in Congress to vote. They don't have to know about the issues. They just calculate who's paying them to vote which way, and that, you know, it's a mathematical calculation.
I also think they're scared. I mean, I've seen a lot of very good Congress people try and do things. And you're going up against a system that's sort of gotten away from itself. You know, you have the most powerful financial mechanism Helen ever created was the federal credit. And basically JP Morgan Chase is at the heart logistically. You know, they are the most important train tracks for running that credit in the New York Fed member banks, who are the depository for the U.S. government. Right. So the U.S. government operationally is entirely dependent on JP Morgan Chase and all these folks for, you know, extraordinary number of day-to-day logistics. I mean, if anything, they're in control in many different ways. So, you know, you've got to, if I'm in a company and that company is doing bad things, then the stock exchange cuts me off, or my creditors cut me off, or, you know, but the money stops. And the problem with the federal credit is, as long as the military is successful, you know, the federal credit keeps on going. And the question is, how do you stop it? And if you're a government official, how do you say no? Because there's no, you know, financial responsibility does not generally get popular support. And, you know, so you've got a sort of runaway system. It's like a big runaway train. How do you slow it down? How do you get it stopped? And that's what we're all grappling with. Well, I have to tell you, give out your URL one more time for J.P. Madoff.
JPMadoff.com. And the book is also available on Amazon.
So you can, yeah. And it's a, you know something, it's a page turner. So don't start it, you know, don't start it in the evening, because I assure you, you won't go to sleep. You'll keep on reading. Well, Helen, it's just been a delight to have you on this O'Leary Report. I really appreciate you taking your time. You've been very generous. And I know with the litigation you're doing, you know, you're a very, very busy person. You clearly have an extraordinary new career in front of you. So I want to thank you again. Is there anything else you want to say to our subscribers before we close down?
Just how lucky they are to have you to educate them. You've taught me so much in the past hour. Thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate it. So if there's anything I or our network can do to support you, I hope you will let us know. We'd love to see you triumph in the courts, and we'd love to see anything that can be done to help the Madoff victims. So you just let us know, okay?
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye.